Is this working now? Okay. So, I want to thank Daniel Ferro for inviting me as the organizer of the seminar. And I'd like to tell you about Bell's theorem and stochastic quantization. And I want to explain a little bit who I am and what I'm trying to do here. I'm a condensed matter theorist, and I want to basically switch into this field of quantum foundations. And I didn't have the courage to do this when I was a graduate student. I was told that this would be too dangerous. But now I have a tenured position at the government lab job in Israel. Doesn't give me complete academic freedom, but I can take my sabbatical and do whatever I want. And that's what I want to do. And now, I don't have actually much work in this field, so what am I going to tell you about? So I'm going to have two parts of this talk. The first part is about Bell's theorem and arrows of time. And this part, basically, I'm going to tell you some ideas which perhaps I've reached maybe by thinking about it, but they're not original. So they can be found in the literature, and I'm going to make a lot of use of things that have been found in the literature to explain these things to you. And the only place where I want to go and say I have some ideas of how to do new things is in this last part, where I will discuss stochastic quantization. But there, it's basically at the stage of the research plan. I haven't had the opportunity to devote serious research time to this and do past results. So that's what I can present. And I do promise that the first part will be interesting enough, and I think it's very important, so I won't be wasting your time anyway. So even though there's nothing here which is original and new, I hope you will enjoy the discussion and I'll see from your reactions. So I'd like to start from saying loud and clear that I think no one understands quantum mechanics. And I'm not the only one to say this. This is a quotation from Feynman. And I think many people have used this quotation many times. I want to emphasize a few things here. One is the comparison with relativity, which makes it sort of clear what one means when one says that one does not understand quantum mechanics. The other one is this down the drain thing and the blind alley from which nobody has yet escaped. That was the thing that sort of frightened me when I was a graduate student, so I didn't dare to go in. And I think the other thing I want to say is actually taken from this article. So here's a review of Bell's theorem from 85 by David Merman. And you see that things have actually deteriorated. Instead of saying that, the other one was from the 60s, the Feynman quote was from the 60s. This is from the 80s. And people are saying, is the moon really there? We don't know. They're not saying we don't understand so clearly. They're saying maybe there's a problem with reality. And it's sort of funny. And there's a Feynman quote in this paper from the 80s. And in that quote, Feynman had already mellowed, and he was much older. And he was saying, maybe, it's just that the first couple of generations, when a new idea is introduced, the first couple of generations have problem adjusting to it. And I think this is exactly where the comparison with relativity is important, because it hasn't happened. So. Relativity was also a new idea, and we did adjust, and with quantum mechanics, it's not working. And there's another thing which Merman wrote about, not in this particular context, but another way of thinking about why we don't understand quantum mechanics, how can we make it obvious? And that's that when people teach quantum mechanics, they often instruct their students to shut up and calculate. And I mean, that's probably useful to do when you don't understand something, but you have to say that you're doing it because you don't understand and not just to silence them. This is a quote from something very recent, and it shows that the situation is deteriorating even further, perhaps. This guy is saying, look, the way we discuss the Copenhagen interpretation in quantum mechanics courses and science courses is basically a parallel of discussion of intelligent design in biology classes. We blur the distinction between real science and arbitrary dogma and so on. And he's saying Bohr's approach was to embrace the paradox and give up on resolving it. And so on. And basically, his conclusion is that the theory of the Bohrian Bohm should be taught. So Bohmian mechanics is what he says should be displayed to students as well as the Copenhagen view and so on. I think he's maybe a little bit overstating the point, because some of the problem doesn't come from the Copenhagen interpretation, but from the many worlds interpretation. And I'm not sure I completely agree with him, but at least it shows that the situation is not improving. So let me stop this quotation thing and go back and sort of mention some things which I want you to keep in the back of your head. So quantum mechanics has, from the very beginning, had many formulations, many equivalent formulations. It started with matrix mechanics and wave mechanics, and then there are path integrals, and Bohmian mechanics is also a legitimate formulation. And then there is Nelson's stochastic mechanics, and there are more actually. And it's relevant to the discussion later that all these formulations are deterministic. I mean, of course, there is the Bohm probability rule, so it's not completely deterministic except for this one. But this is the only one where, in this list at least, where you have stochastic elements playing along all the time, which is interesting. And another thing which is much later, but basically when we want to talk about our best understanding of basic physics and things which have been compared with experiments to 10 decimal digits and so on, we have to understand that we're talking about quantum field theory and not about just quantum mechanics, which we're talking about here. And for many years now, we have had the standard model of particle physics. And this development was led by experimental input. And while it was ongoing, it could be argued that attending to the foundational issues was not the most urgent thing, because the dealing with experimental input was perhaps more urgent. But since we have the standard model, I think that argument can no longer be made. And we have to go back to the foundational issues and try to resolve them better. And I don't think we've been making as complete an effort as is justified. So we have a lot of work. So I want to start with the EPR paper, naturally. And EPR stands not only for Einstein, Podolsky, and Jose, but also for elements of physical reality. And it's interesting to note that when Einstein thought about this, he defined a sufficient condition for an element of physical reality to exist. And so he's really avoiding the complicated issue of how to define realism. But he's saying any reasonable definition of realism would have to at least obey this. And if you take into account that he was also assuming locality, which we will come to, of course, then there's no way you can sort of continue to do science without accepting this. So I think this has to be accepted, and there's no point in denying realism in this sense. I mean, I can give you references where they argue this systematically, and they say if you deny realism, you're still going to have to deny locality as well in order to deal with Bell's theorem. So it doesn't help you to deny realism in this sense. And what he says is that if there is a circumstance where you know you can predict something with certainty, the value of some physical quantity, then there exists an element of physical reality corresponding to that. And the other thing I want to emphasize here is that he's avoiding the issue of stochasticity and dice, you know, God does not play dice and so on, by choosing to focus on situations where the probability is 100%, so there's a prediction which is made here. And the conclusion of this paper is that quantum mechanics is incomplete, not that it's inconsistent with something. But in fact, Bell showed that the same assumptions lead to something which is in strict in disagreement with quantum mechanics. So I'm going to go through that. So there's a summary of Einstein's views and what it means when he says locality. He says there is a region V and there is a region A, and what happens in region V, what really happens there, cannot depend on something that happens in region A at the same time, if there are separate regions, and shouldn't depend on whether or not anything is happening at A at all. And he says if you compare this with quantum mechanics, you see that quantum mechanics doesn't obey this. So there's something wrong. There's something, basically he's saying there's something non-local in quantum mechanics. And what he's saying is that when he looks at all the phenomena that quantum mechanics describes, he doesn't find anywhere a fact which would indicate that some things have to be non-local. So he's not willing to accept non-locality. And Bell did find this fact, so that's that brings us to 1964. So I'm going to describe this, and I'm going to follow Merman's presentation. So this part, I'm taking just a few slides, which is basically a journal club-like presentation of Merman's piece in Physics Today. So we have a region A, we have a region B. There are two pieces of equipment here which are measuring devices. Different measurements can be made. You can choose by setting the switch. And there is a source which emits particles which hit these two receivers. And one of the important points is that this has been done experimentally in various labs. And the most notable one is the lab of Aspect, which I'll discuss later. So this is a kind of black box description. There is a button on the source. You can hit it and make it emit particles. And the particles are the only communication between the source and the measurement devices and so on. And so you randomize the switch settings, you push the button, and you record the results. So in this case, this has been pointing at 3, this at 2. This shows a red light, this shows a green light, and you just summarize the results like this. And then you run lots and lots of these, and you get, say, millions of these. And you can analyze this in two different ways. One is to focus only on those cases where the switch settings happen to be the same. So here both were 2, here both were 1, and so on. Ignore all the others. And what you notice immediately is that the lights flash the same color in these cases. So this is, shows very strong correlations between the two particles or the two measurements. Now, the other thing that you can do is to just ignore all the switch settings, and you look at the results, and you find that they are completely random. You find that there's an equal probability of finding red-red, green-green, or red-green, or green-red. So they're all equally probable. And then you understand that there are no correlations in this case. And you can think, well, it's a bit surprising. One way of looking at it, you have perfect correlations. The other way, you have no correlations, but is this really unreasonable? And I want to persuade you that it is. And in order to do that, you have to go through two steps. The first step is to realize that if you look only at the first part of the perfect correlations, you have to reach the conclusion that the particles have some, they're carrying some information, and they know already when they leave the source what colors they're going to flash. I mean, if the switch setting is 1, then it might say red. If the switch setting is 2, it might say green, and so on. And there's no other way. I mean, this could be coded in some way. The particles could come in different shapes, or the source could emit them in different directions. It could be coded in many different ways, but somehow these instruction sets have to be there. And the way to see this is to say, well, look, if I want to know in advance what this particle will show here, all I have to do is to move this detector closer to the source, put it on the relevant switch setting, and I will already know what this particle is going to show. So by using this definition of elements of physical reality from EPR, we can we realize that this particle already has this property, and there must be an element which corresponds to it. And we can do the other, and it must be independent of whether we brought this closer, whether we made this measurement or not, because we could not do this measurement, and we could do a different measurement here. And if things are widely separated enough and so on, there's no way that the other detector could know about this. So from the first part, the perfect correlations, we deduce that there must be hidden variables. And then if we assume that there are hidden variables, then we can look at specific values of these hidden variables. For example, in this case, we have RGR. And we can ask ourselves, what will be the result if we analyze this in the second way, which leads to no correlation. So we randomize the switch settings. And then there are 9 different possibilities of putting the switch settings on both sides. And if you look at this case, you have 5 of the 9, which will flash the same color on both sides. And the other 4 will not. So you have 5/9 of the time will have the same color. And 4/9 of the time, you will not. So you get a little bit of correlation from this particular choice. And then you realize that all the other choices of hidden variables here will be similar, except for the ones that are homogeneous. So RRR and GGG are going to have the same color splash all the time. So if the source emits sometimes these and sometimes those types of particles, then it has to give correlations which are at least 5/9 and can go up to 100%. And then they can never be 1/2. And so you find that it's not possible that the experimental results were like that, basically. I mean, you're showing from reasonable assumptions that that's not possible. But quantum mechanics, under some circumstances, I haven't told you what's in the boxes yet, so what kind of particles are being emitted, but I'm going to. So what's in these experiments? There are pairs of photons, and they're emitted, I mean, the vast majority of you know all this, but they're emitted in a state which has an overall spin zero, singlet state. And therefore, they can be shown to have these funny correlations. So we can think of these, the detectors might have polarization measurements, polarizing beam splitters, which send the photon one way or the other and show the correlations we're talking about. And if the 3 switch positions represent putting these polarizers at 120 degrees, then we get the result that when they are at 120 degrees, when they're distant from each other, the chances of getting the same light on both sides flashing is 1/4. And if we look at what happens for, if we put them on the same switch settings, then the photons are going to be correlated and they're going to have the same polarization. And if we look at what happens for random switch settings, well, 1/3 of the time we have 1/2 of the time we have this 1/4, and that gives us a total of 1/2. So that's the lack of correlation we're talking about. So this shows that actually the instruction sets cannot exist, and therefore there are no hidden variables, at least that's what you would think. And the experiments were improved over the years. I mean, they started rather early. By 81, there were experiments where actually the choice of the switch settings was being made after the particles had already left the source. So if you think of some kind of conspiracy where the particles, you know, despite the fact that we said that there were no communications between the parts of the machine, maybe just before the source emitted the particles, it did feel something happening, and it already knew the settings of the polarizers and so on. So there were some clever tricks to divert the photon, make it go into one direction or another, where there was one kind of polarizer or another. And these tricks made this sort of close this loophole. And there are perhaps other experimental loopholes, but the likelihood of them being a problem is very low by now. So you're being extremely quiet. I'd like to have questions or something. Yeah?
Well, so if you're willing to just accept that no hidden variables don't exist, then you agree there's no problem?
No. Because then you clash with the first result. I mean, the first result is the perfect correlations that you find when you look at those cases where the switch settings were the same. And those force you to accept that local hidden variables do exist. And when you look at the second result, you see that they can't exist.
Well, they sort of force you if you're thinking in a classical framework. Mm-hmm. You did ask for
a local classical framework.
Pardon?
They force you if you're thinking in a local classical framework.
So actually,
part of the argument is that you're sort of having a kind of a proof that local hidden variables must exist by considering that scenario. And that therefore, if you assume that they don't exist, you immediately get a contradiction.
Yeah.
No, the locality is not
true. So this slide is to go through the assumptions that I've made.
So that's one of your axioms, though, that they must exist, local hidden variables.
It's not one of the axioms. The axioms are listed here.
Okay.
And then the result of these axioms is that for the second type of analysis, you must get correlations, whereas the result of quantum mechanics is that you don't. So this gives you an inequality. These axioms lead to an inequality, and quantum mechanics and experiment disagree with this inequality. So you understand that something must be wrong. But it's not that you've assumed hidden variables here. You've been led to that from the axioms. So the assumptions are you assume realism. I mean, that's basically the only way to do science.
The assumption of hidden variables? What's the difference between assuming realism and assuming hidden variables?
Well, so that's the point. If you assume, let me see. You really should think in terms of Einstein's definition. So if you don't accept locality, then that definition falls apart. Because you might do something in some other region in space and that would influence things, so you're not sure what your elements of reality are, and you're not sure how to say that, you know, there's something here which is real and something there will not be able to influence it. But if you do accept locality, then there's no choice but to accept that view of realism.
to give a sufficient condition to be.
Right, and that's enough. That's enough to be able to go through the logic and show that these hidden variables must exist and to reach an equality. The hidden variables are not assumed. They are deduced from these assumptions. That's an important point.
And basically, if you assume realism, you think one step or two steps away from hidden variables.
If you assume realism and locality, then you get the hidden variables from there. Yes?
I think if you just, some people are saying, if you just assume realism, even without locality, you would get something that you would call a hidden variable. So, like, imagine that you did this measurement in region V, and it's complete, so you've done the measurement.
Okay.
So now you can go, now you can, with probability 1, predict something about region A.
Right.
You can make a prediction with probability 1. It doesn't matter so much that it's about a space like region or wherever it is. So there should be some element of reality corresponding
right.
to that prediction.
Yeah.
Even if you don't assume locality.
Yeah, I'm not saying that if you don't assume locality, you will not be able to have realism.
No,
I'm saying actually something that goes in the other direction.
The statement is that if you assume realism, whatever that criterion is called,
yeah.
then there's some hidden variable in the sense of some element of reality that from which you could deduce the result of that measurement that you didn't yet make. And I'm just saying that argument is independent of locality.
Right, yeah. I mean, you can make
so,
it independent.
Some people are making these comments that
yeah.
if you assume realism, you're very close to already having
yeah.
variables.
But I really think that the main problem here is if you try to analyze what realism means, you get too deep into philosophy, I think. Realism is something that as physicists we have to accept. And I don't think we'll be able to make progress if we don't accept that.
Can I just add a comment as a sort of character example to the idea that realism implies hidden variables? Because if you don't accept locality, you could say you can be realistic about a wave function and have a non-local wave function collapse. Now, that wouldn't be a hidden variable theory in any normal sense of the term, but it would be a realist theory that was non-local, and that would be able to explain the correlations. But obviously,
right.
Einstein
so
projects, but on locality.
Right. So what? You know, one way of doing that is exactly what is called Bohmian mechanics. So you have this wave function.
You could be realistic. Once it collapsed, if you could infer it collapsed,
which you could be.
Then it could be. Then you could just call it a different wave function. I mean, maybe it's a bad name, but I mean, it would play the same role as you're pointing out.
How did the wave function collapse?
Hidden variable. There you go.
I think that way. Okay, I'm just.
Yeah.
Maybe you should state what you mean by realism here.
I don't want to be specific about it. I want to say. I want
you
to
just want to fake it. Sorry.
I want to say that I don't think, I mean, I'm not going to specify what I mean by logic either.
Oh, all right.
Okay? I want, I mean, basically,
so
if I have.
So two things, but we don't want to pay off.
I think, you know, every physicist who's basically past high school knows what these things are. And if I go into discussion of them, I will not be contributing to where I want to go in this talk.
The whole point of these quantum experiments is that what we thought they are isn't necessarily what they really are.
No, I don't think so. I think what they show is that we don't have local causality. And I think there's agreement among the researchers who have looked at this seriously that that's what they show. And that all this discussion of, you know, is the moon really there, and what is realism, or quantum logic, and things like that, are not really, they're not really hitting the issue. The issue is with local causality. So, and I just want to quote that from the literature without being too specific. I don't want to get into that because that's not where I have something to add.
So for the rest of the talk, you want to explore the possibility that local causality is really what needs to be changed.
Exactly.
So then we don't need to worry about the other stuff since that's what you want to focus on.
Right. Yeah. And I think, you know, people who want to pursue it in a different way can also actually, at the end of the day, agree, as you said, that if you think about it, you really do have realism. If you think of your wave function as something real, you have realism. And what you don't have is local causality.
Why can you say the scientific manifest
is on the
website? Isn't this just an
example of scientific manifest? So, well, if you think of imagine that we build some robots, and we're very advanced technology, and we give them the technology of quantum information technology and, you know, communication and so on. Basically, we're going to be able to demonstrate using these EPR correlations that these robots exhibit something which you would usually consider as unscientific. I mean, but they would exhibit something that looks like telepathy. They would be correlated in a way that could not be explained except by having some kind of hidden communication. Not a strong kind of communication, not something that would enable them to transmit information from one to the other.
That's not really scientific method, but maybe scientific preconceptions.
So that's exactly the point I'm trying to make. We have to distinguish between things like telepathy, which, if they really exist in the real world, then we have to adapt the scientific method to study them, which is what we're doing in quantum information.
It sounds like what you're talking about is just taking an assumption that there's no such thing as telepathy and then falsifying it, which is following the scientific method a la Popper.
Right. So, but, you know, imagine you were studying agriculture. And you were looking at, you know, pairs of seeds, and you separate them, and you grow one under one conditions and other under other conditions. And come on, I mean, you're not going to persuade the people looking at the agriculture studies scientifically that what you do to one grain is going to affect the other. So there's really something funny coming up going on here. And the point I want to make later is that it's not necessarily telepathy. It might be foresight. And that's the distinction I want to make.
But just make a comment. When people studied telepathy scientifically in the 40s and 50s, in fact, Turing, in his paper on computer machinery and intelligence, considers it as a plausible objection to his theory that machines might be intelligent. So I don't know that you need to say this to make where you're going, but I don't think that this has anything to do in particular with the degree, you know.
Maybe I'm using the words a bit too. Maybe I've chosen words which are a bit too harsh.
Because it makes it sound like Newtonian gravity was actually scientific, but it has action at a distance.
I think you just mean scientific preconceptions. I think scientific preconceptions are under stress.
Or our idea of stress time.
Yeah. Yeah. I accept that. By the way, this is not my own choice of words. I mean, I'm using words which have been published. So it's perhaps not the best choice of words. But so here's a typical recent exposition of the situation. And the conclusions that are made are that there are only two possible ways to understand this. One is that there is non-locality, and the other is that there is non-realism, okay? And the first one is said to clash with relativity, and the second one also has something to do with distant events. So here too, there is something which relates to a non-locality somehow, and it's not clear. I don't think that this can really be defended. You have to go with some variant of this, but if you look, it's not what I want to suggest. The other variant that I want to suggest is not really described here, except in a little footnote in one of the middle pages of this discussion, where there are things said like you could refuse to consider the correlations mysterious, which is sort of non-scientific. Or you could say that the ordinary logic does not apply, which is also not what you would like to say. And you can deny free will, which is something which Bell himself has discussed. In the sense that this is a type of conspiracy idea. You deny that there is genuine randomness in the choice of the switch settings. So if the experimenters are not free to choose the switch settings at random, then you can make the arguments fall through. And the other thing is that you can entertain the idea of backwards in time causation. And this thing is also treated as if it's not serious or some kind of conspiracy or something. But I don't think it is. Because if you think of local causality, it certainly doesn't follow from relativity by itself. Relativity is completely time reversal symmetric, and causality is exactly breaking the symmetry between past and future. So the question is, can we cast doubt on causality?
Can you say exactly what you mean by local causality?
Well, what it means is that this particle, which comes out of the source, can affect what's happening at the detector because it sort of carries the information with it to the detector. But the detector cannot affect what's happening at the source because that's backwards in time. That's the assumption of causality. And locality means that, you know, that the detector cannot affect what's happening at the other detector because that's far away, or it cannot immediately affect it. So, you know.
What is immediate?
Sorry?
What do you mean by it cannot immediately?
Well, if you were to think of some effect which propagates from one detector to the other, you could perhaps allow things like that.
But it's not in space, but you mean if the other
detector... No superluminal signals, I would assume.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in order for one detector, or in order for anything to affect anything else, there has to be a signal carrying the effect somehow. And the causality issue is saying that this signal only travels forward in time, and that it travels at speeds not greater than the speed of light. But by the way, Einstein was not discussing the speed of light necessarily. Einstein was looking at things simultaneously. And he didn't mention causality at all. He mentioned these two particles which had been interacting in the past. So there was mention of the past and the present. But he didn't mention causality. In Bell's paper, the assumption of causality is explicit. He mentions causality. He says that he's looking at things which are local and causal and so on.
So what's the principle of relativistic causality? Causality and relativity are in conflict.
No, so what I'm saying is that they're not...
causality is not reversible.
You cannot deduce causality from relativity. You have to add something. You have to say, I take relativity, and I also take some preference for some direction in time. And when I combine the two together, I can... deduce local causality. But if I don't take this other ingredient, if I don't take this arrow of time from somewhere, then I won't get local causality just out of relativity. And relativity is time versus symmetric, like most microscopic theories. And the whole point is to emphasize that when you want to throw something out, and you say, okay, so these results actually force us to give up on some element which is important in relativity theory, it's not clear that that's the way you have to go. You could perhaps give up on some element which is important in time's arrows, in the way we understand time's arrows. And our understanding of time's arrows is much less clear than our understanding of relativity. I mean, time's arrows, even before we had all the 20th century revolution in physics, even in the 19th century, time's arrows was quite a complicated discussion, and it hasn't become much more clear. I mean, there have been some advancements, but it's not become as clear as relativity theory, for example.
But just, I mean, in a non-relativistic world, non-local quantum correlations aren't a problem, isn't that right? Because we would have arbitrarily large speeds. You could imagine if variables that just propagate.
That's true. So you can have something like Bohmian mechanics, which, yeah, that's a legitimate point, but it's not the only legitimate point.
That's why I'm a bit confused when you say Einstein didn't think about relativity. It's relativity that makes a problem.
Yeah, I think Bohmian mechanics is not an example because it doesn't actually have something propagating from the one detection to the other, from the one
Well, but the waves are influenced in a way that is non-local.
If you take the wave as real, then it's some non-local thing in the first place. But Rob is saying you could have perfectly local theory that would not conflict with the Bell inequalities if you didn't have a maximum propagation speed.
Yeah.
You could just have little things zipping back and forth.
Yeah, but then, okay.
So I mean, I think that in the EPR setup, I don't know whether they mentioned it explicitly, but it seems like they should have had in mind space like separated regions, because that's the only way you would know without in any way influencing. How do you know that what you do here doesn't influence this? It's only if there's some assumption.
Well, but
separated.
In fact, what they were saying was that they were looking at two separate regions at one instant. So it's clear that they're spaced at separate regions. But they're not saying that explicitly. They're not mentioning the speed of light as a limit to the speed of information transfer. They're just saying it's not reasonable to expect there to be something zipping around because we have no indication of something zipping around, and it's not.
But that seems like a
well. I don't see why not. I mean, you just say this is evidence there is something.
Yeah.
Well,
actually, this is the setting in which more than that people discuss the speed of propagation of quantum communication or of speed of collapse. Because they consider that the norm for all normal interactions, objects are space-like, and then they try to estimate how quickly you should zip things back and forth to get the Bell-type statistics.
Yeah.
From there they get those bounds like 10 to the 5th, 10 to the 7th speed of light. But the starting point is exactly
if you were willing to say forget about relativity, then you could do this with hidden variables zipping at high speeds, and the speeds are 10 to the 7 times the speed of light.
Yeah.
That's empirical.
Yeah.
It's like a lower bound. That tells you how accurate experiments are.
Lower bound on the speed of those crazy things.
Well, those crazy things,
That tells you how accurate experiments are. It doesn't tell you what's going on.
Anyway, you want to give up arrow time.
Okay. And of course, you know, that would be, it's not only me. I mean, there are people, there's this philosopher, Hugh Price, in Sydney, Australia, who's been thinking about this really thoroughly. And he's analyzed the necessary conditions for giving up on the arrow of time on causality, because you know if you do it in a way which is sort of simplistic, you immediately run into causality paradoxes. You can go back in time and change things in a way which would affect the present in a way which is inconsistent. So you must be doing something in a very subtle way in order to avoid these. You can't just say
if you give me a crazy position, I'll find you a philosopher and I'll rigorously argue for it. So that's not a good argument.
No. I'm not saying that's a good argument.
Thank you, Joy.
I'm not saying that in itself is a good argument. But,
let's just say people are seriously thinking about how to do this in a way that's empirically satisfying.
Yeah. So let me try to be specific. So let me give you one example of what he's saying. So he's saying, look, imagine there's a tribe in some old days, and the men have gone hunting, and the women are stayed back at camp, and the men are now on their way back from the hunt. Is it legitimate for the woman to pray that the hunt has succeeded? I mean, the men already know if it succeeded or not. But the women are praying to the gods, and they pray that the gods may make the hunt succeed. And now, of course, it depends on how you look at it, and different philosophers will have different ideas of whether it's legitimate or not. But it's not completely logically inconsistent, provided that the information is unavailable to them. So there's this information about whether the hunt succeeded or not is inaccessible to these women who are doing the praying. Okay? And then, if you assume that it's really inaccessible, then maybe, just maybe, depending on your philosophic position, this could be consistent. It's not obviously inconsistent.
Is this argument to assume that praying is somewhat logically consistent in the first place? Are there different contexts?
So the idea is then to say, once you've understood what I mean by saying that there is something inaccessible in the past,
And if it is inaccessible, then it's not stupid to say that something might affect it, even though it's in the past. Then now you realize that quantum mechanics is full of these things. Because quantum mechanics, there, you ask yourself, which slit has a particle gone through? And you realize that that's an inaccessible piece of information. You cannot know, you cannot say anything, you cannot measure it. If you measure it, of course, you ruin the experiment. I mean, you're not going to have interference.
Well, if I can foresee where you're going, you've already accepted reality as simulation of old Fermat.
Right.
So what's the reality of the hunters walking back from the hunt if they were unsuccessful? That seems to clash with the notion.
Of course. I mean, come on. They're not quantum phenomena. So I'm just using that to explain what I'm talking about when I say that something is inaccessible. And you would think that, you know, okay, no serious physical theory should have these inaccessible pieces in it. But quantum mechanics actually has them. We've gotten used to having inaccessible pieces of information in quantum mechanics. There are all these forbidden things which we are not allowed to touch. We're not allowed to ask, you know, if there's an intermediate state and the system can go through several intermediate states, we're not allowed to ask which state the system has gone through. So it's sort of quantum mechanics is exactly the type of theory that you would expect to see if you try to analyze in a way which you impose an arrow of time, a theory which does not really obey the strict arrow of time. So
when you see quantum mechanics as full of these,
Can we stop the discussion for a second and let the speaker move on?
Yeah, let me move on.
Just finishing with his time. And afterwards, he's here for the rest of the week. Please drop by and help.
Yeah, I'd be delighted to discuss this a lot. So anyway, I want to give you a concrete example. So think of these experiments. And think of this intermediate state in the cascade. There is a J equals 1 state there. And if you measure the direction of this spin of the calcium atom or electrons between the emission of the first photon and the second photon, of course, if you measure this direction, you would ruin the EPR correlations. So we can imagine that this direction is actually represented by an angle theta. And to take this angle and imagine that it somehow knows about the angles of the polarizers, theta A and theta B. And it chooses at random one of these angles. And if we do that, then we get a model which easily reproduces all of those correlations because we've made something non-local, but we haven't made it directly non-local. We haven't informed one side of what's happening in the other side. We've informed the source about what's going to happen at the detectors. So it's easy to make such models. And actually, Bell, in his original paper, had a different model, which was more of the non-local type. I mean, he said, look, if we allow one detector to know what the other is doing, then we can easily make a model which reproduces the results. But his model was different than this one. And it's interesting to ask how we could distinguish between the models, or perhaps build more detailed models for this, which is where I wanted to take you. So I do want to say that this, if you think of this model, and you think, well, okay, I'm going to allow this break in the arrow of time, then you would describe this as local realism, because it's a realistic model and it's local. It's not. It doesn't have causality, so it's not local. It doesn't. The locality is usually an abbreviation of local causality. So you have to emphasize that what I've dropped here is the requirement of causality, and not locality or realism, not local.
I don't know if I understand what you're saying quantitatively here. Is this a coherent superposition of the angle theta amongst those four possibilities?
No. It's just if you allow the source, if you assume that every time you hit the source, it asks itself, it somehow is capable, you know, through foresight, to know what the angles of the detectors are going to be in the future. And it chooses randomly between these options, just with usual probabilities. then you can easily build a model that would reproduce the results. And by the way, I would like to mention this type of I mean, this model is really assumes or that things are going to be similar in this situation are going to be similar to this situation. So imagine you take this polarizer and you move it this way, and then you ask yourself, what's the probabilities they're going to be like in the EPR or the Bell experiments. And you ask yourself, how are we going to discuss, how are we going to describe this photon? And invariably, you know, we tend to discuss this photon, it's being polarized by this polarizer, so its state here knows something about this polarizer. But if you think, I want to avoid this discussion with the arrows of time and so on, it's reasonable to think that the state of the photon here knows about this polarizer as well. I mean, unless you impose the arrow of time from the outside. And the way that we usually impose the arrows of time are actually from initial conditions, and not from not something that happens at every point of space-time, but only in some initial conditions, like these discussions of thermodynamics and so on. So I want to ask if it's possible that the arrows emerge from the initial conditions, and they're not strictly enforced microscopically at each point in space-time. Here's an analogy. Imagine there is a world in which there are beings and they think about their physical surroundings. And imagine that in this world, the sun always hangs in the east for some reason. And so they would feel that the east is always hot and the west is always cold. And they would come to think that they're different fundamentally. But actually, it's only a matter of boundary conditions. And I want to say maybe the past and the future are different because of similar boundary conditions somehow imposed by the Big Bang. So I'm not going to ask what, I'm not going to try to analyze what the Big Bang was like. I'm just going to say that maybe we can think of boundary conditions as imposing that all the time in the macroscopic sense. Let me skip this. And try to go back to end this part, which is a bit philosophical. And you know, philosophers are allowed to think about anything. And sometimes they think about issues which are concerning to physicists. So I'm not saying that philosophy is useless. But I want to go into theoretical physics and build models which are mathematically detailed, like this Bohmian mechanics and so on. And it's sort of ironic, but I want to say something like, quote Bohr and say, let's try to find models which describe what's happening and see what we can say about them, and not worry too much about how nature really is, but about what models we can build.
By the way, that's not really a quote from Bohr. That's a memory of one of Bohr's students about the sort of thing that he used to say.
That's quite possible. I was a bit worried.
I know.
I was a bit worried myself that Bohr is being misrepresented in these quotes. So thank you for this. But anyway.
Well, it's retrocausality. So.
Okay. So. Now I'm going to say something which may strike you as familiar from Feynman and Wheeler type of arguments and so on. So imagine that you have an oscillating dipole, and it sits somewhere in space-time, and it's only in some limited region. And imagine that you have something, let's take classical Maxwell's equations, and ask yourself what's going to happen. And if the oscillating dipole emits waves or absorbs waves, actually depends on what the conditions are away from this oscillating dipole. I mean, the Maxwell equations are consistent with waves coming in or waves leaving the source. So you can have either advanced or retarded waves. And then the standard thing is to say, well, we impose some boundary condition here. And if the boundary condition doesn't contain any waves, then where this forces, the only remaining solution is one that the source emits waves. And then that's enforces causality in practice, because now if we play around with the source, it can only affect the future. So because these equations are deterministic, what happens between this boundary, if the boundary is completely fixed, and there's nothing happening between this boundary and the time that the source starts operating, all of this will be completely fixed. And so there will be causality, even at the macroscopic level. But if you don't use a causal model as a deterministic model, if you introduce some stochastic variations in your fields, or you can also do that in the boundary conditions. You can say the boundary conditions are not completely fixed. They vary stochastically within some distribution. But that's a more complicated situation. I would like to consider first the simpler one, where the boundary is completely fixed, the values of the fields are fixed at the boundary. And then, if you assume that there are some fluctuations in the fields around the classical solution, then you would have some effects here, perhaps, and not everything would go in the forward direction. So this would, if you have a limited amount of these fluctuations, then you could have something that's causal and has this arrow of time on the macroscopic level, but not strictly on the microscopic level.
Quick question.
Yeah.
Why would you not describe a likely solution as causal? Isn't it well, different things are the causes? Go back. In other words, you have the waves coming in and then acting on the source. So the waves are, in some sense, the incoming waves are the causes. It's the motion of the source is the effect.
Of course.
So it seems like you have causality there, too. But it's a different story you can tell about what the effect.
So what I'm saying is a bit different.
Okay.
What I'm saying is if you impose a boundary condition which doesn't have anything in it, it's completely flat, so it does, can't be the cause of anything. And you go with a deterministic theory, then you have basically imposed causality, because now nothing in this region will know about this. Okay. Now, if you want to introduce retro causality in this type of model, you can apply final conditions instead of initial conditions. You can still do that.
Yeah, I don't know why you call it retro causality, but if it's not important to your model, then just take the word for now. But maybe
you
just
disconnect
issues on this
case.
Okay.
What
you're going to do.
Because I'm sure it's fine. Yeah. Okay. So let me run forward. So I want to say that actually there is a theory. I mean, what I did earlier with this model, which had just this J equals 1 angle, was trying to address sort of discrete elements of reality. But what I'm saying here is that we can also think of continuous fields and have a distribution. And actually, such a model exists. There is this thing called Parisi-Wu stochastic quantization. And it's basically an alternative formulation of quantum field theory. It agrees with quantum field theory to all orders in perturbation. And it's... So maybe we can just use it instead of trying to invent some new models. And that's what I want to propose, basically. So I'm going to try to explain to you in, I don't know.
5 more minutes.
OK, so I'll try to use 1 minute to explain what stochastic quantization is. So you know what Wick rotation is. You can go from real time to something, to imaginary time, and then instead of discussing propagators, you're discussing like a thermal distribution. And then you have a Euclidean action, so you can discretize this time, or treat it as a continuous variable. It's the fourth dimension of this imaginary time, and it has periodic boundary conditions, at least in simple cases. And then you can say, well, OK, this type of formalism is amenable to calculation, for example, with the Metropolis algorithm. So you can try to jump from one configuration to the other. And in terms of computation time, you're going to go through these configurations. But there's also the Langevin approach, which allowed me to go through the configurations in a different manner. And if you now try to go back to real time and apply the unrotate the weak rotation, you get something where the fields are actually complex and the probabilities are not. If you just apply this type of thing here, you get finite path integrals, so the probabilities are complex. But if you apply it to this Langevin approach, you get real probabilities and you can work with this. And the pricing phase, the fields are complex, and you have to worry about this regularization. It's complicated technically, and I haven't mastered it myself. I would need several months to study it. But it does allow you to work with real probabilities.
Are you saying this is an alternative formulation of quantum mechanics?
Of quantum field theory, in fact.
Well, quantum field theory in particular.
Yeah. Yeah. That's you know, this Parisian Wu paper has over 600 quotations. And
I know it exists, but I thought it was just a way of computing. In my mind, it was just a way of computing correlation functions.
Well,
essentially by... I mean, the fact that I don't know about is the complex field, and I don't understand what role that plays. But are you saying that they're, in the end, producing, you're working only with classical probabilities? And you,
yeah.
get, a, and you get a, say, an S matrix or something like that?
You get...
you don't have to do an analytic continuation.
No, you've done the analytic continuation, and you get... all the Green's functions of quantum field theory, all the correlation functions. So it's a way of attacking. I mean, these guys, I quoted earlier, are actually using it to obtain numerical results for simulations of quantum field theory in cases where you don't have you have time events. So it's a dynamic. Situation, studying the dynamics of quantum field theory and looking how the interactions affect it and so on. So it's at least some of these people say that it's a complete alternative formulation of quantum field theory. And I guess they're right, but I haven't studied it thoroughly enough to be absolutely sure myself. Yeah, so I have to skip. And so the idea is to take this situation and to ask myself, okay, so this now apparently does allow these small fluctuations statistically around the classical fields. And now I want to put a detector here and to see whether it can feel what happens later in time and move the detector here and see what it feels then and so on. So I can build a model where it's absolutely clear what is an external influence and how information can flow, say, in a backwards direction in time, because I can build a model where the detector clicks if I have a source operating here, according to this theoretical construct. And then I will know that this somehow sending information backwards in time, this model is not appropriate. Okay? I hope that I will be able to build a model where it will be appropriate. And I think that the detector is going to be complicated. It will have an internal degree of freedom to respond to the field, and it will have to have some kind of dissipation, and maybe have to be initialized in a metastable state so that it can flip and fall into some other state. And it's going to be a complicated story, and I don't know how it will unravel. But if it does work, then we can put a double slit into the experiment, force the fields to obey some boundary conditions corresponding to a double slit. And then you can really examine things that are bound to look like particle wave reality and exactly what Feynman was talking about. You know, he was discussing the two-slit experiment immediately after these comments about don't try to understand it. So this would be a way to understand this. And if it fails, it will be interesting to find out how. I don't know how it can fail, but I'm I actually am not too optimistic about it succeeding, because I don't have a clear enough picture of what's going to happen. And then the next step would be to introduce an EPR source, so try to model these calcium atoms, and to see whether, if you now look at the details of how these fields are responding, are they similar to the discrete model that I was suggesting before or not? And I think that if all this works, then you could call this lenient causality as opposed to strict causality. So you are imposing causality, you're using boundary conditions to impose it, and but you're not doing it on a microscopic level, you're only doing it through the boundary conditions. There are lots of additional issues to discuss, but let me jump to the conclusions. And so one thing which I didn't completely argue for, but I think is correct, is that saying that local realism fails is not legitimate. What's failing is local causality. And you have to emphasize the issue of arrows of time, which is one of the assumptions of Bell's theorem, clearly. And this type of phrase really hides this issue. I mean, when you say local realism, you're not mentioning arrows of time at all. And I think that's a big mistake. And okay, there are various other points. And I want to end with saying that we have to go into the spine valley and look and try to find a way out. And it's not being done thoroughly yet. Thank you.
I have first a comment and then maybe a question. I don't think that the second line actually just, I have all the sympathy for realism, I'm a realist myself, but
okay.
It doesn't follow from the logic of the arguments that have been put forward, Bell and the followers. So I think one has to go into the details how this is the case, but you can't really say that
well, so at least I hope to persuade you that what you have to say is that the combination of local realism with causality is what is failing.
By local realism, people mean local causality. Realism.
I know that that's what they mean, but they're not saying it. I want them to emphasize that the arrow of time is one of their assumptions. And what they're emphasizing is that relativity is one of their assumptions, and they're willing to give up on that assumption. And that's, I think, not in place.
I mean, you want to add to the list of things assumed an arrow of time, basically.
Yeah. Which, now, if they say local causality is assumed, then that's fine, because that has the arrow of time mentioned in it.
That is
if they don't mention it, then it's not fine.
By local realism, that's what is meant.
I know that that's what is meant, but I think that's a misnomer.
And also saying that they should assume the arrow of time, would they move? When people talk about relativity, they talk about time where interval Minkowski stuff.
Yeah. Of course.
So that is an error. So they implicitly.
Yeah. They distinguish between the future light cone and the past light cone. They don't treat them equally. Whereas relativity, the core theory, I mean, Lorentz invariance, doesn't distinguish them.
So after that, I have positive comments.
Okay.
Okay, suppose we accept this. This is a nice project.
Okay.
It's a very fundamental assumption that you're questioning about the arrow of time.
Right.
Making it like, it would be interesting to see what experiment one can do to check whether this is your assumption.
Yeah, okay. So the so what I'm proposing here is to try to build a model that would reproduce the results of quantum mechanics completely. So you won't be able to distinguish between it and quantum mechanics experimentally. And the only advantage that you can get out of it, perhaps, is if you have an alternative formulation. It's the same type of advantage like finite path integrals. It gives you a different way of calculating, but you're going to get the same results. But however, I do have some hope that if this works, and you know, and we can progress to another step, and after we do these simple models, maybe we can do this to the whole standard model with all the gauge fields and so on. And maybe when we go beyond that and go to something that perhaps involves gravitation as well, then maybe you're going to have some specific predictions for the type of experiments that Penrose has recently been pushing for, where you try to have interference between macroscopic objects. And his claim is that because of gravitational effects, you will discover some decoherence, which is not in the standard quantum theory, but comes from the gravitational, comes from the fact that G is not zero, but small. And maybe one day you could get some concrete predictions for experiment to check from this type of idea.
The question was about the formalism that you're using, stochastic.
Yeah.
This is my theory of notice. Is it completely equivalent to local quantum field theory? Or is it the possibility that it's...
So it's been proven to be equivalent to all orders of perturbation theory. And at some point, some people asked whether it's going to be the same beyond perturbation theory. And that was unclear. So if you have questions of what happens to quantum field theory beyond perturbation theory, it's not clear that it's completely clear. But I don't think that that's part of quantum field theory as being verified experimentally. So I don't know if that's something to worry about. Yeah?
The question of the experimental confirmation just reminds me of an issue that's come up, as I recall, in connection to this whole sort of backwards causation debate. I forget whether it was Shimoni discussing it or Bell, but it's related to your earlier remark about the impossibility of doing science, okay, in another context. That's in it. I think that there was a worry expressed, so I don't know if anybody remembers in case Shimoni talking about it, because this idea has been around in this guy.
Yeah.
In Beauregard, he pursued
of course, yeah. He started with this before Bell's paper.
Okay, anyways, but so that if you had this, then you couldn't do science because you couldn't freely adjust your experimental conditions. Because one way of looking at something like this, at least if it's deterministic, now maybe you can tell me whether your stochastic approach avoids this, is that you have something coming out of the source, which is constraining the setting.
So this is something that I have encountered, and I have a specific answer to this
good
query. And again, I'm following Christ, so I think that in this case he's right. So the question is, how come, you know, what we're assuming is that something at the source is correlated with something at the detectors. And now what Bell says is, well, that means that the experimentalists and the detectors don't have free will. But that's exactly the opposite of saying backwards in time causation. Because if you think this is backwards in time causation, they do have free will, they do whatever they want, and the source follows their actions. And Bell did not accept this. Price tried to explain this to Bell, and Bell did not accept this. Bell thought that this would require that somewhere in the far past there would be some very complicated conspiracy that would lead to the correlations between what happens at the source and what happens to the experimentalists who make their decisions. But that's completely unnecessary if you break the arrow of time. If you think, you know, if you're allowed to influence what's in your past life cone, then you don't have to imagine something complicated happening in the further past.
Right, well, I think that there's the general, my sense of the whole problem here is that trying to make room for free will while constructing a deterministic theory of the ordinary, of the kind Bell has in mind or the kind Price has in mind, is problematic. It's very hard to say what counts as a free action in the theory. So this is why you get into these.
So I think this is a response.
It's an adequate response by Price, but it doesn't really give you any room for free will. There is no freedom in Price's the way he's looking at it.
Yeah. No, I prefer a stochastic approach.
A stochastic approach is cured this. That's what I'm sort of wondering about.
I think it makes room for it, but you have to, you know, in Bell's, in Bohm's theory, you have this non-local effect which is carried by these waves, which is capable of telling the particles what to do and sort of allows the non-local effects to become real. And what Bell understood Price's approach to say was it would require an even more elaborate mechanism to do that. But I'm saying no, I'm saying you don't need that. And what you do is you need to start with a theory that's microscopically time reversible, And I think that you need to start from a theory that's stochastic. I'm not saying that it's necessarily the only way to do it, but I think that's a good way to start and try to check if it works.
In a deterministic theory, as several people were sort of hinting, there's not really a distinction between forward causation and backward causation. Both are valid.
But you know, everybody knows that Newtonian dynamics is causal because everybody knows the parts of applying Newton's equations is supplying initial conditions and not final conditions. So you break the symmetry by hand.
That's when you don't know the full intermediate conditions. But if you knew the full intermediate conditions,
of course,
then it's...
Yeah.
So I think you're right. If this is going to be something fundamentally different, it seems like it has to be stochastic.
Okay.
I mean, that's what I think several people, like Steve, were hinting at or saying.
If there are no further questions, I think we'll stop here. The last thanks speaker again.